Welcome to Be All You Are, a Midlife Awakening podcast. I'm your host, Kaina Paranjape. I'm a former corporate executive, two-time entrepreneur, and mama. I've worked with and partnered with major brands and even helped a celebrity launch an award-winning business. But I also believe that who we are is not just reflected on our LinkedIn profile. When I was 30, my husband became suddenly critically ill, and after 8 years of living with a difficult illness, he passed away. This experience taught me that we need to claim our dreams now, embrace all we are, and create an amazing life along the way. Today, I help women like you navigate through change and transition to their next level of freedom and fulfillment, whatever that looks like for you. This podcast is all about stepping into all you are. It's about reconnecting to your inner voice so you can hear the whispers of your deepest dreams and cultivate the courage and a plan to create the life that is waiting for you. Now head out on that solo walk or settle into a cozy spot with a favorite beverage and join me. Well, hello, friends. Welcome back to the show. One of my goals this year is to speak at and attend more events. I love learning more from other women's lived stories, and attending events allows you to hear them in real life, right? In 3D, as much as I love a good podcast. But when you're listening to a woman's stories in real life, I find the lesson so much more powerful and impactful. About a month ago, I spoke on a panel at an event called the Collective Summit here in Toronto. It was a day packed with inspiring, empowering speakers and conversations. I myself spoke on a panel about entrepreneurship and the entrepreneurial journey at any stage of life. But I was also able to tune into some of the other panels. On another one of them, I listened to my guest today sharing her story. I was immediately drawn to her story of overcoming and becoming. And I had to head right over to her after her talk and invite her to come onto the podcast. Jordana Goldless is a criminal defense lawyer and a TEDx speaker. She specializes in serious offenses, homicide, assault, drugs, firearms, robbery, no joke. But our conversation today isn't directly about her work or the cases she takes on, which of course she can't talk about anyway. This conversation is about her own incredible story and what we can all learn from her experience. When Jordana was a young teenager, she suffered from mental health challenges and turned to drugs and alcohol, as many do, to cope. She eventually ended up on the street, was arrested twice, and became, as she describes it, a teenage junkie. But Jordana's story is evidence that where someone starts need not predict where they end up. I know you're going to be amazed and inspired by this conversation. Let's dive in. Welcome, Jordana, to the show.
Thank you for having me on. How are you?
I'm great. I have been so looking forward to this conversation. Personally, you know, I'm excited to share with my audience, but, you know, as I was sharing with my audience prior to us starting this conversation, you and I were at an event together, and I didn't know about you before that and heard you speak on a panel, and I was so taken by your story and so moved by your story and so inspired by it that I was very excited to reach out to you when you agreed to come on and have this conversation with me, and so that I could ask all the questions I wanted to ask while you were on the panel.
That's very, very fair. Yeah, you were very quick to approach and tell me all about this amazing podcast and your incredible initiative, which I think is just absolutely phenomenal. So thank you for including me in your journey.
Yes, of course. Well, I think it's so important to tell these stories. And I especially love how your story so deeply informs what you do now. And that's sort of what I want to like touch on full circle in this conversation. So I would love, Jordana, if you could share with our listeners your story. So leading your story up to where you are today as a criminal lawyer and the work that you do, but, you know, bring us along the journey.
Sure. I mean, I'll do it, I guess, in broad strokes, given our time restrictions. Yes, yes. Essentially, I am the product of a very broken home. I started acting out as a response to some pretty significant emotional and psychological stressors that were in my life growing up from a very young age. They culminated in me acting out around the age of 12, started engaging in some really self-destructive behaviors, a lot of attitude with my teachers, but I was an excellent student. So it was sort of difficult for the school to navigate my issues. I started engaging in self-harm, drug abuse. There was sort of a litany of different, what we now label mental health concerns, but all culminating from the same place. My mom did everything she could to try to get me help, was trying to do the right thing, having me in various programs, seeing social workers, psychiatrists. Unfortunately, back then, the response to most adolescent behavioral issues was medication. And so I was put on a cocktail of psychiatric drugs at the age of 13, which I did not respond well with. They actually exacerbated most of the symptoms that I was suffering from. And so the response from the psychiatric community wasn't to, oh, maybe we should scale back and find something different. They increased dosages and then also made arrangements to send me off into residential treatment. Mm-hmm. And so I spent 1 month in a crisis facility, followed by 18 months in a group home that process started the day after I turned 14 years old. Mm-hmm. So I was really young when I was taken from my home. And really suffered significantly within this setting. And so as opposed to finding me the help that I needed back then, it really just increased my reliance and my dependence on various substances. And so when I was tossed out of that group home situation, my response and my coping mechanism primarily was in addiction. And so drugs really took a hold of me very young. I was 15 years old when I, looking back, if I had to pinpoint the time in which I became a drug addict, that was it. I was 15 years old. By 16 years old, I was I was on the journey to my bottom for sure. Started getting arrested, started getting kicked out of school. At 17 years old, I was expelled from an entire school board. I fought their decision myself only because I didn't want someone kicking me out, but I didn't actually want to go to school.
Be there.
So I successfully appealed the school board's decision to expel me.
Foreshadowing.
The same year because I couldn't cope. And so by 17, I was officially a high school dropout. I left home, was on the streets, and that lifestyle really continued for a good 2 years. Just before my 19th birthday, I suffered a near fatal drug overdose, which I'd like to say was the impetus to me getting clean. It was not. It was the impetus to me thinking about getting clean, but thoughts, of course, don't translate automatically into action. It took another 6 months of me really hitting different lows and bottoms for myself before I decided to call it quits. I went into what then was my fifth rehab program at 19 years old. I spent 6 months really learning how to live again. It was the first time that I had done a program of that length.
Okay.
And it really was what I needed for me in order to not only address now the addictions, but the underlying issues that were really the force behind my addictions. Mm-hmm. And so I did that. I got clean. I got back into a high school program. I moved back home. I very slowly rebuilt my life. I was 21 years old before I graduated from high school, so very sort of late in the game. Didn't know what I wanted to do, but knew that further education was probably needed in order for me to support myself and have, you know, the type of lifestyle that I really wanted. So I applied for university without much of a goal. you know, a lot of people ask me, oh, did you always know you were going to go into law? Mm-hmm. I wanted to be a lawyer when I was a little kid. That goal was dashed during my crazy teenage years. Mm-hmm. And so when I started off at York University at, you know, 21 years old, I didn't know what I wanted to do. I just knew that I needed further education. Mm-hmm. And so I did what I found that I loved, which was philosophy. So I spent 4 years studying philosophy. And in my third year, I knew that I needed to do something else than leave school with a, you know, undergrad degree in philosophy. Mm-hmm. So I applied to law school just based on my sort of childhood dream and the notion that let me at least try. And if I don't get accepted, I'll at least know that I tried. Yeah. You know, it really wasn't a thought. And so at the same time, I also applied to do a graduate degree in philosophy because in my own mind, I was not getting into law school. I was trying to get into law school.
Plan. Just
say that I did it. Mm-hmm. And lo and behold, I was offered a full scholarship to do my master's degree in philosophy, but also offered the opportunity to attend Osgoode Hall Law School, which had been my dream, you know, from way back when. Unfortunately, during my undergraduate years, I not only made some serious educational achievements, but I had also relapsed. And so mm-hmm. in my last few years of undergrad, my addictions were really, really taking hold. And the summer before I was set to start law school, I didn't think that I was capable. I didn't think that I was in a position where I could walk away from the lifestyle and the drugs that I had reimmersed myself into. Mm-hmm. And luckily, I had a friend sit me down and basically say, listen, you've been on this path before. You can always go back to this path. Why don't you just try law school and see what happens? And it was really with the same attitude I had towards applying to law school. Let me try it. Yeah. And if I fail, I fail. I know I tried, mm-hmm. you know, and I got into law school. So I started off, and that first semester, I was literally quitting everything that my life had previously been about for about 10 years. You know, I walked away from friends. I walked away from a lifestyle, a routine, and most difficultly, a lot of substances that I thought were sort of a crutch or a support for me up until that time. So that first semester was a huge adjustment. But once I started passing classes and getting by and really getting a grasp on what I was doing as a law student and realized like, oh, I can probably graduate from law school. I don't know that I can be a good lawyer. I don't know mm-hmm. if I can be successful, but let me at least put my all into this. And so I got sober in that first semester completely and walked away from everything I had known for over a decade and really put all of my eggs into one basket. And mm-hmm. that was lawyering. And so came out, at the begging, pleading, negotiating skills of my mother, who said, please do not go into criminal law. You've spent the last, you know, 12 years of your life being a criminal. Can you please just be a lawyer? Was what she said to me. And I was like, you know what? I owe it to my mom to do that for her. And I wanted to really make her proud. She had sacrificed a lot yeah. in trying to help me change around my life. Mm-hmm. And so I started my career in civil litigation, corporate and commercial and real estate. And, you know, all the normal questions you just get asked about it at dinner parties. And I focused on that for about 2 years. I articled and then spent 2 years practicing. And I just couldn't do it. It wasn't who I was. It wasn't what I was actually interested in. I wasn't passionate about it. Mm-hmm. Even though I worked with a great team of lawyers, I had fabulous mentors. I was doing well financially. I was very comfortable. It didn't motivate me. I didn't open up my eyes every morning and think, yay, I get to go and be a yeah. commercial litigator today. And I needed that. I'm someone that's driven by doing what I enjoy and what I'm challenged by. And mm-hmm. so I made this switch in 2010 to criminal defense. I started off working for a firm and I loved it. I just focused on being a really good lawyer. Mm-hmm. So I didn't worry about bringing in work. I didn't worry about, you know, the business side of things. I focused first on the lawyering aspect, learning rules of evidence, learning, you know, skills in how to cross-examine. And the better I did within my practice, sort of naturally clients gravitated towards mm-hmm. me. And so I ended up building a practice sort of within this firm setting. But I wanted a different business model for my clients, and I wanted to offer a different approach to my clients. So I branched out on my own. I opened my own practice in 2015. Mm-hmm. I spent 4 years by myself, but I had other lawyers sort of on contract that were helping me run my files. Mm-hmm. And then 4 years in, my practice had just grown to such an extent that I couldn't do it on my own. So that's when I started hiring help and associates and students and sort of trying to figure out different business models that work. And I'm still sort of tweaking. I think now I'm finally in the right place with the right team behind me. But it's, you know, it's taken the last 9 years to really get to that point. And also there's been a huge development within my practice. So my practice has grown each year. The needs of my practice have changed. Mm-hmm. Clients' needs have changed. Obviously the pandemic switched the way that things are done within within law and within business. Mm-hmm. So we've certainly had to pivot and respond to that with every change. But it's been a really phenomenal journey. So I now have a really great practice that I've developed over the last 9 years, fabulous clients that I really, really, I really adore. I work well with the majority of people that I work for. And that to me has been huge. You know, when you said initially how I have used my experience to really create the practice that I want, it's true. I wanted a practice that focuses on the person and not yes. just the charges and not just the law. It's not just yes. the person isn't just a file. You know, it's someone's life that I'm dealing with. And so for yeah. me, that's really important. I always think about what would I want if I was the person charged and how would I want to be treated and how would I want to be defended? And so that's
and it's
really
incredible because you've been there, right? That's what's so incredible is exactly. that you've been there. So you know what it felt like to be on the receiving end and potentially or, you know, mostly not have people treat you that way.
No, exactly. It's mm-hmm. what I think that I do different in a lot of ways. I think there's other lawyers that do it, but I think we each have a different niche and we each bring different skill sets to the table. So yeah. for me, it was always important to treat people as I know they would want to be treated based on how I would want to be treated coming mm-hmm. from the same place.
Mm-hmm. You have a tagline, and I know you've also done a TED talk, but the tagline that I see a lot on your website and just in general in your content is "Who judges the judge?" Can you yes. share a little bit more about where that came from?
Initially, for me, it was a hashtag that I developed on Twitter. So many, many years ago, I think before I even left my law firm, I started using Twitter as a way to sort of challenge what the police were doing, to challenge inequities I saw in the system. And so I would share various news articles dealing with corruption, excessive force, mm-hmm. things of that nature, even situations in which, you know, marginalized communities were being mistreated mm-hmm. By the government and those that should be serving and protecting those communities. And it was more of like I wouldn't say a call to action, but a call to question what is around us. And so mm-hmm. I would just hashtag who judges the judge, mm-hmm. which is meant to, you know, who questions those at the very top of the hierarchy,
yeah.
right? It was never meant literally there's a body there's a political body, a committee that literally judges.
Yeah, there is somebody that judges the judge. Yeah.
So, most certainly is that built within the system. The point of it was, you know, we have people at the top of the food chain that we as a society think we should just inherently trust mm-hmm. because of their title,
mm-hmm.
right? We are taught from the time we're growing up, you know, there's cops and there's robbers, and one you respect and want to be, and one you don't, you want to send to jail.
Yeah.
But those lines are very much blurred when you peel back the title and look at the person.
Absolutely.
And again, it's not to say that all police are bad and all robbers are good,
yeah.
but it's not the case that just because someone bears one of those titles versus the other, mm-hmm. that we know the character of that person. And yeah. so who judges the judge? It started off as a sort of social commentary about the inequities in the justice system. And it's sort of been expanded to also, you know, think about the way we judge various groups and various humans without ever taking the time to learn about them. you know, for me, and because I've been on both sides and I've worn so many labels, right? Mm-hmm. Like I spent my teenage years rightfully labeled as this teenage junkie. Mm-hmm. I was a high school dropout. I was a criminal. I was all of these, you know, words that we associate with very negative connotations, but more problematically, poor character, yeah. right? Those yeah. labels would have resulted in people considering me to probably be of low intelligence, inarticulate, unmotivated, not capable of success. And so I've really turned that on its head, I hope, at this juncture of my life.
I would think so.
And I mean, that's part of why I talk about the way that I was. And I don't shy away from these derogatory terms, yeah. right? I was a complete junkie. I was a street kid.
Yeah.
And yet I always had the potential to be what I am today. I just needed the help and the support to overcome some of my demons in order to realize that potential. Mm-hmm. And I'm not unique. Right. And that's one of the biggest problems in our system is we look at so many people and write them off for what they've done. But what they've done is most likely and most often a product of the situations they're grown into and the people they've surrounded themselves with and yeah. not a function of who they yeah, are as being.
Yeah.
And so that's what is about. It's about peeling back the labels that we as society deem as good people and bad people. Yeah. I've also known a ton of, you know, judges that are not good people, mm-hmm. lawyers that are not good people. Mm-hmm. You know, does that mean all lawyers? No. I mean, that's the problem with our society is we label everyone by group, but mm-hmm. you know, you don't know that until you get to know someone.
Yeah, absolutely. And I wonder, you know, if you find yourself noticing that just again in our greater society, not just necessarily in, you know, among criminals and lawyers and judges, but just in general, there's this saying that if you knew everyone's story, you wouldn't be able to help but love them, right? Because in the end, even the most hardened person has a story. And oftentimes that story is heartbreaking and it shapes like who they became and why they became that way. And it just makes me think in general about how we tend to look at each other and put each other in groups, right? Like if somebody believes one thing, it's like they're dumped into a group, right? Instead of like being, well, why do they believe that? And what's their understanding of it? And how can we close that gap? Instead, it's, you know, throwing a label on somebody and usually it's a good or bad one.
Absolutely. And, you know, believing one set of facts doesn't mean that we disbelieve another set of
facts.
Right? We live in a world today and it's frightening the degree of polarization.
Yes.
You know, we see it time and time again to the detriment of ourselves and the greater world around us, mm-hmm. right? Because as soon as we start creating that division based on one line of thinking, we've really cut off so many people that we can be learning from and growing yeah. with and yeah. supporting each other.
Yes, absolutely. And I think we saw that get so much worse during the pandemic, right? Like if somebody has a question or is questioning vaccines, that makes them an anti-vaxxer. And then that makes them not believe in science and, you know, like not believe in masking and against the government. It's like it blows up instead of being like, well, why is this person nervous about vaccines? Like, there's a story there. Maybe there's a lack of understanding. Maybe whatever it is, right? I think that's so interesting, and I love that the work that you're doing, although it is like in a specific arena, it calls on all of us to ask some of these questions. You know,
absolutely, and that's what the TED Talk was really about. It was trying to bring some of these questions into the foreground so that people who are not only in the criminal justice system, but society at large can take a minute and say, oh, wait a second. You know, it's easy for me to turn my nose up at that, you know, young woman on the corner that's asking for spare change. But who knows not only what brought her to that moment, but what could be ahead of her yes. if she could only get the help and support she needs. Because nobody actually wants to stand there and beg some stranger for money, right? Like the reality yes. is that's never someone's goal in life. And, yeah. You know, I'm sure if we took surveys and said, if you could do anything in the world, is this what you want to do? we'd be shocked at how few people would say, absolutely not, I would do anything other than this.
They can't
get the help they need and the resources they need to dig themselves out of that situation.
Yeah. On this podcast, we talk a lot about tuning into your inner voice and how your inner voice can guide you at those pivotal points. And I'm sure that through, all the trauma that you experienced at a young age, it was hard to, and of course, substances mask that completely, but it must have been hard to tune into that. I'm curious, there's like four points that stuck out to me in your story. There was, coming out of that extended treatment later in high school, where you came out and got clean, or maybe that was 19 or 20. You were 19 or 20 then, right? And then there was the time when you relapsed and then had to really make that choice. Like you said, that friend asked you, like, what if you just give this a try, right? And it was sort of this pivotal point where I could go back and do this. This actually feels, it's completely uncomfortable, but it also feels comfortable because I know it and I don't know this, right? So it was like another point there. Then the point where you decided that commercial law was not for you, this moment where you're like, this is like, I'm going to do this. I want to do this for my mom. And then there's a point where you decided, this is not in alignment with who I am and really why I feel I'm here. And maybe it didn't present itself at the moment, but that's basically what it was. And then you chose to, move into criminal law. And then the fourth that stood out to me is when you were like, this is amazing and I can feel the impact I'm making and I'm, but I want to do things differently. So there was that fourth kind of pivot for you where you were like, I see an opportunity of how I want to do this. I'm curious if you found yourself like having that conversation with your inner voice and whether that evolved and grew over time.
I mean, for sure, when I got clean at 19, it was an inner voice. I had this moment. I had a really horrific multi-day relapse into a drug that I had said I wasn't going to do in a way that I promised myself I wasn't going to do it. And then I did like 2 months later. Mm-hmm. And I just looked at myself and felt so helpless. Like there I was, this teenage drug addict, gave myself permission to do basically anything in any which way except one. And now here I am back at it. And I just felt broken. And so there was, definitely an inner voice or something inside of me that just said, you could probably live like this for the next 20 years, but do you really want to?
Yeah.
I felt like there was no bottom left for me to reach. Mm-hmm. Like this was it. I could not imagine being in a worse situation. I didn't think there existed a worse situation for me to fall to. And I thought I could either stop this lifestyle completely or stay like this for the next 20 years, but die like this. Mm-hmm. There was really no place left to descend to. And it was, and I guess it was, you would call it an inner voice, something inside that just said, I don't want to die like this.
Yeah.
This is not how I want to die. And that's not to say that death was intimate. It might have been. Mm-hmm. I could have gone out the next week and done the exact same thing and died of a fatal overdose. Mm-hmm. I could have been in the next situation and got shot. Like, it could have been. I was living a lifestyle where I could have died at any time, but I may not have been. I was young enough that mm-hmm. plenty of people stay in that life well into adulthood. Mm-hmm. So I could have. The thought was, do I want to?
Yeah.
Do I really want to stay in this place and live this life mm-hmm. until I die? And I didn't. And I realized at that point that the only thing left for me to do was to get completely sober. And I couldn't just give up one drug and I couldn't just give up one method and I couldn't just stop using in a certain way. I had all of these ways that I thought I was going to outsmart my own addictions, right? Because that's the nature of the addict.
Yes.
I can drink my face off, just don't do cocaine. Or I can do cocaine, just don't smoke crack. Or I can smoke crack, just don't shoot it. Like mm-hmm. there's always a way that the addict mind works to try to maintain that active addiction. Mm-hmm. And it took an inner voice saying, there's nothing you could do at this point. Mm-hmm. You cannot negotiate this anymore. You either need to get completely sober and not use drugs, or stay and die. Mm-hmm. That's really what it came to. And so I didn't want to die and I didn't want to stay in that life anymore. Okay. I called an addictions counselor that had tried to get me into the 6-month program when I had overdosed 3 months earlier. And I told him I wasn't ready. I wasn't mm-hmm. ready to give up drugs, even though they almost just killed me. I wasn't ready to leave the lifestyle. I wasn't ready for any of it. And I thought I could do it my way. And I called him and I was like, I can't do this my way. I have to do this your way. And I was done. And I did. I went into the program and I gave it my all. I was the only one during my entire 6 months that actually graduated from that program. I was the only one who continued on. And of my friends that were using at the time with me, I am the only one that I know who's gotten sober, let alone yeah. created a life. So it's sad, like statistically yeah. to think, you know, those of us who make it out and those who don't. I don't yes. know anyone else who fell to the level I did with me. I know plenty of people who've gotten sober, you know, in their own way.
Yeah.
But for me, I was the only one in my circle. So yeah, I think it was inner voice for sure. I don't spend a lot of time, you know, I don't meditate. I'm not into mindfulness. I haven't spent time in the wellness sphere. Mm-hmm. I don't think about, you know, inner voice and whether or not that's what is guiding me. But, mm-hmm. you know, I think about it as my gut instinct.
Yeah.
I think about, you know, that was always my mom's sort of go-to with me is follow your gut, listen to your gut, mm-hmm. you know, whatever your instinct is to do, just do that because that is what's right. You know, don't sit and think too much about it.
Yeah.
So yes, you know, when civil got boring and I was getting frustrated and I was unhappy for an extended period of time and it wasn't about one case and it certainly wasn't about my firm because they were amazing. It was really just about the nature of the work and I wasn't passionate. I just knew,
yeah.
you know, when I lost that, I stayed with my criminal law firm for 5 years and tried to do things the way I wanted them done. And again, it wasn't, I was getting amazing work. I had great clients. I loved my boss. There was no, you know, fighting there. There was yeah. no issues. I know that there's a lot of complaints right now about the law society being particularly unfriendly towards women. Mm-hmm. I never experienced that. There was no, it was quite the opposite. Mm-hmm. Always felt a great deal of respect within the firm. So it wasn't about me being unhappy with any one thing. Yeah. And that was the deciding factor. It was like, how is it that all stars are aligned and I'm still
yes.
not happy?
Yes, 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 yes. That's interesting. You know,
and I think a lot of people, they try to justify their own unhappiness. Yep. They try to minimize it,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I could have done that. I could have been like, I have a great boss and I'm making good money and I get good work. And, you know, why would I leave this? Mm-hmm. Which is true. But I needed to do things differently. I knew there was a different model that I could follow. I knew that I was capable of doing it differently. And yeah, I just felt like if, you know, again, if all stars are aligned and I'm still unhappy, then I got to find a different constellation.
Yeah.
And so that's what I did. So I guess it would be listening to inner voice, mm-hmm. Paying attention to, you know, how I think and how I feel. And it's how I often move now. It's how I still make business decisions for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I love that. I think, it takes so much bravery to realize that your happiness, like to not minimize your happiness, as you said, right? To not just say to yourself, oh, well, all of these things are right. And so what's wrong with me that I'm not happy? Like, I think a lot of women do that. They say, well, what's wrong with me that I'm not happy? I have all these things. When really it's like, well, question what... The happiness isn't that you're not grateful for all these things. The happiness is often that something's missing or that you're meant to be stepping into something new or something else, something more aligned, right? And that was definitely the case for you. Yeah.
Oh, for sure. Every step of the way has mm-hmm. been, I can do things different, bigger, better, more. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't really stay satisfied a certain place. And mm-hmm. so it's recognizing that I can do it differently.
Yeah. Jordana, do you feel now that you are doing this work and you have your own firm and have been running it for several years, do you feel that you have found your life's purpose? Does this feel like your life's purpose to you? It may evolve into different iterations or how it looks, but does this feel like this is it for you, or do you feel like you're still on the search?
No, I don't think that I'm necessarily on the search. So this is the only thing I would do in law. Mm-hmm. So I am at the pinnacle of my legal career, mm-hmm. for sure. Mm-hmm. I don't think this is all I will ever do. You know, I think I've organized myself so that I have maybe another 6 to 10 years in the profession before I'm in a position where I can retire from the profession. Mm-hmm. And there are certainly other venues that I want. There are certain things in life that I want to do other than a legal career.
Yeah.
But that's later.
Yeah.
So right now where I'm at, I'm very much happy, mm-hmm. with where I'm at. I'm happy with my practice. You know, I've built it, I've created it, I've refined it over the years. Will it change in terms of the nature of work that I do, the cases I do? Maybe, mm-hmm. but it won't be a different practice area of law, right? Like I don't wake up and I'm like, oh, I got to go be a criminal lawyer. I don't feel that at all. I mm-hmm. still wake up and know that there's nothing else in the world I would want to do with my law degree than what I'm doing.
Yeah.
So that's for sure. I love how I've done it. I'm not looking to, you know, scale into a bigger firm. Like I'm at a size that I want to be at. So there's things that we'll always tweak year after year. Mm-hmm. And there's, I'm sure, new challenges that will come up, but I can't imagine doing anything different with the career that I have, for mm-hmm. sure.
And do you find yourself, because you are a prominent lawyer and you're well known, do you find yourself looking at what other lawyers are doing? I mean, we all do this, right? But I think that there is real value in not. So I would love, because I for some reason I felt called to ask you that question. So I'm curious about your answer.
Yeah, no, I do not pay attention to what anyone else is doing. I don't know what other people are doing. I don't pay attention to what other people are doing. There's so much work out there that everyone can succeed. I don't feel like I'm competing with anyone. Mm-hmm. You know, I have my little practice area. I like my practice area. I'm focused. I don't really network with other lawyers. It doesn't interest me. I connect better with my clients than I do with other lawyers, mm-hmm. because at the end of the day, I still am who I am, and I come from the world I come from.
Yeah.
So, you know, if I have to choose between a birthday party for one of my good referral sources who happens, you know, to be a convicted criminal, and I know that there are going to be other people that I know and choose to associate with at that party, mm-hmm. and there's a competing, you know, female lawyers dinner, and everybody's going to be networking, 1,000% hands down, every time I will be at the client's birthday party.
Yeah.
For sure. Yeah. And my good clients know that. I will always, I make an appearance, I show up. I prefer that. And it's
that.
Comfortable. It's, you know, for me, that's what it's about. It's about connecting with people. It's about helping people. It's about recognizing that people come to me with a problem and I'm just there to solve it. I'm not there to change them. I'm not there to change their life in terms of like telling them they should do things different and make better choices. That's not my role, mm-hmm. at all. And I think once you step away and realize what your role is, then you're not, you know, you can do things a little bit differently.
Yeah.
I'll just put it that way.
I love that. There's so much power in that, really.
It's like a racehorse, right? You think about it. When racehorses don't have blinders and they're busy looking at the other horses, do they fall?
Yeah, that's right.
Well, you know, you stay in your lane and you keep your blinders on and you focus on what your own goals are. And the reality is we're all moving towards different goals.
Yeah.
Right? Like what other lawyers aim to do with their practice isn't what I aim to do with my practice. Mm-hmm. So why am I looking at what they're doing or paying attention to what they're doing? You know, every minute that I'm paying attention to someone else is taking away from the time and energy I should be spending on my own practice and my own clients.
Well, I think that's such like a good lesson again for all of us, is this idea that if you're constantly looking at what other people are doing, then it's impossible for you to know where you want to go, right? Because you're just like using everyone else as a reference point instead of saying, where do I want to go? And asking that question. So I think that's really powerful.
We're just putting that energy going where you know you want to go.
Yes.
Like, I don't give a shit where everyone else is going. Yeah. Like, I know what I'm doing. Any minute that I spend caring about what someone else is doing is time that I'm not spending caring on my own goals.
Yeah, absolutely. So this podcast is called Be All You Are, a Midlife Awakening Podcast. So a lot of my guests are, you know, 40 and up. And I wanted to ask you, A, if you're comfortable sharing your age, and B, how you are experiencing your life and career at this stage of your life.
So I will be 45 in June. Okay. So I'm 44 on the cusp of hitting the mid 40s.
Yep.
I don't feel it. I don't act it. Mm-hmm. People that meet me can't believe mm-hmm. that I'm as old as I am, which I love. You know, there are times where it catches up to me where I'm like, oh shit, I'm 44. I can't do this. Be in this situation. Mm-hmm. But those are few and far between. Mm-hmm. You know, I think I've worked so hard for the last 14 years and positioned myself in such a way that I have the privilege of being able to do most of what I just want to do. Mm-hmm. And so the older I get, the less I care about what anyone else thinks of me along the way, which is really, I think, the epitome of freedom.
Absolutely.
You know, to do what you want, how you want to do it, when you want to do it, and not care, you know, what someone else thinks and what the world thinks, mm-hmm. as long as what you are doing is right, as long as what you are doing is what you believe in, mm-hmm. and you think that it's going to either support your goals or support the community around you. Mm-hmm. That for me is freedom.
Yeah. Beautiful. I love it. I wanted to ask you, Jordana, if you know, have a bit of a public profile, like how can people follow you, engage with you, listen to your TED Talk, of course, like how can people sort of get to know you and the work that you're doing more?
So certainly my website has a lot of my material on it. So articles I've written, successes I've achieved within my career, podcasts, interviews, it's all there. So I have a media page on my website, which is jhgcriminallaw.com. Instagram is a great source of just seeing what I'm up to on a regular basis, but it's also a great source for anyone who's interested in the law and criminal law specifically, because I do try to provide, you know, value and advice and answer general questions that I receive mm-hmm. on a daily and weekly basis from people. And so I sort of chart what people are asking and when there's a trend in, you know, themes that people are curious in, I put out, you know, informational videos to try to answer those questions for people more broadly. So Instagram is always a great way. Okay. TikTok as well. LinkedIn, I'm there. I don't check it as often. So people have to be a little more patient with me when it comes to LinkedIn, but certainly finding out anything and listening to my TED Talk, it's easiest to do through my website. So jhgcriminallaw.com. On Instagram, it's just at Jordana Goldlist.
Okay, amazing. Well, we'll include those links in the show notes. I have a couple more questions for you, Jordana, before we wrap up. The first one is, and I know that you reference it more as like, you know, following your gut feeling versus your inner voice or your intuition, but how do you connect to that voice? Do you have, like when you're in at a point where you are unsure or you're trying to make a decision or something doesn't feel right and you haven't yet put your finger on it, how do you tap into that so that you can make a decision from the place of your gut?
I mean, I think there's a lot of overanalyzing in your question. Mm-hmm. I'm not trying to be blunt, but you know, that's the whole beauty of your gut instinct, mm-hmm. right? You're facing a decision. What is your first response? What is, you know, if I'm hiring a new employee, for example, mm-hmm. you know, when someone walks in and they shake my hand and something in me is like, no, I don't think this is right, I won't hire that person. I don't spend time thinking about it, tapping into it, analyze the situation. It is what it is. If that's how I feel as a gut reaction, then that's what I go with, right? Going with your gut is listening to that gut reaction that you can't understand.
Yeah.
Right. I think as soon as you start trying to analyze it, oh, why do I feel this way? Do I feel this way? Is it right to feel this way? You're not listening to your gut anymore. Right. Now you're not going with your intuition. Now you're going, now you're basing it on intellect, and your intellect is not going to explain to you what your intuition is trying to tell you.
Yes.
So as soon as you start trying to analyze it, you've already shifted away from your inner voice, and now you're just trying to intellectualize it.
Yeah, no, that's so true. I think what for a lot of women, the challenge is that they have not spent a lot of time listening to that first reaction, as you said. And so it kind of gets jumbled up with all their other thoughts and teasing it out. But I love how you said that for you, and this is a really good lesson, it's just that first reaction. So, you know, even if your next thought goes to something else and your mind goes to something else, remembering what was my first feeling when it came to this. Sounds like that's what you're saying.
Always, always. I move through life at a really quick pace.
Yeah.
Like really quick pace. And so for me, I don't want to sit there and analyze why I think about something, why I feel about something. As soon as you start like drifting like that, you're not listening to your inner voice anymore. Now you're ignoring your intuition, number one. And number two, like it's taking a long time to go through that thought process unnecessarily, right? If you're going to just make decisions based on intuition, then make decisions based on intuition.
Yeah.
Right. If you want to spend 6 weeks fucking analyzing a problem, no problem, do so. But now you're going to waste 6 weeks that you could have been spending doing something else. And the reality is there's very few situations, especially in business, that you can't undo.
Very good point.
You know, so it's not that my intuition has always been right.
Yeah.
It's just I can always fix it.
Yeah.
Right. If I hire someone and they figure out a hot something else, right? Yeah. Like that's the reality. Yeah. And it's very rare that I make the wrong decision and can't backtrack on it.
Yeah. That's a very good point. I think that's a good point because I think we also do have a lot of us have a very high level of risk intolerance, right? We're very like, we feel that everything is risky, but when you truly look at it, most things can be course corrected. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't, I'm just trying to think of like situations, you know, there are times where I have ignored that intuition. Mm-hmm. There are clients that I've taken on against my better judgment or against my first reaction, quite frankly. And I always regret it. I'm always like, shit, I knew that I shouldn't have done this, but now I'm in it and we're going to go through the process. Mm-hmm. I think that's the beauty of like your inner voice.
Yeah.
You're not supposed to be with it, right? Yes. It's your inner voice telling you do A, don't do B, and you just got to go with it and listen to it, right? That's the whole point of it.
Yeah, that is the beauty of it, as you said. I love that. Okay, Jordan, I have one last question for you. And this is a question that I ask all guests on the podcast. What do you think it means to be all you are?
I think it means pushing past your comfort zone. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people live life mediocre. And I don't mean that from an outside yardstick. Mm-hmm. I don't mean in terms of the things they have, the money they make. I mean in terms of their own potential. I think a lot of people, and it ties back to your last question, a lot of people spend all this time analyzing their current situation, and they spend so much time thinking about what they're going to do instead of just doing it. You know, and I think that it's really important to just put yourself out and see what you can accomplish. An old friend of mine used to ask me what capacity I'm working at. And at the time he was posing that question to me, I didn't understand it.
Yeah.
And he's like, from what you're capable of, from 0 to 10, you know, what's your current capacity level? I was
Like, I don't understand. I feel like I'm always 100%. He's like, really? You're doing 100% of what you think you're capable of? And it took me a while to think about it. I'm like, maybe I wasn't. Maybe I needed to push past that and do more. And so being all you can be is pushing past your comfort zone, right? And doing more all the time. It's, you know, we get so comfortable living at a certain level. And that's not all we can be. And it's very rarely all we can be. We can always do something more. We can always do something better. We can always help those around us in a different way. And I think being all you can be is constantly thinking about what's next. And it's not about I'm unhappy with where I'm at right now. You know, I could push pause on my life and do exactly what I'm doing right now for the next 10 years and be, you know, very comfortable. But that's definitely not me being all I can be. Mm-hmm. You know, for me, I can say right now, everything in my life is beautiful. My practice is running great. I have an amazing team. I have great clients. I'm in a beautiful relationship. Love my friends. Like, my health is good. You know, all the checkboxes work. But I'm still always thinking about what's next.
Yeah.
You know, what's the next big adventure? What's the next thing I want to accomplish? And I always have a list of what's next in order for me to reach that capacity, because I'm not there.
Do you think that, I think that's so beautiful. Do you think that the early part of your journey informs how you live your life now? Like, is there a part of you that has that fire and that like sense of like, am I challenging myself? Am I pushing out of my comfort zone? Am I thinking about what's next? Is that informed from, you know, all the things that you went through earlier in your life?
Absolutely. I'm always, from the time I got clean, I wanted to see what else I could do and just how far I could get from that, right? Like, you know, from street kid to law student, and then it was from street kid to civil litigator, and then it's, you know, to criminal defense lawyer, and then it's the business owner, you know, and then. And so, yes, it's always a question for me of how far I can get from the world I came from, really just to set an example that we can do it. That mountain climber that says, I want to get to the top of that mountain. He gets to the top of that mountain. You're like, all right, which mountain is next? Instead of looking down and being like, wow, I did all of that. You know, I spend very little time looking back and saying, holy shit, I can't believe how far I've come. Yeah. I spend a lot of time looking forward and saying, but that's where I'm going to get to. And I do a small glance and be like, because that's where I'm coming from. So yes, I do think a lot of my life and my journey and my drive, I think more so my drive. So the way I practice for sure is informed by the life that I live.
Yeah.
But my drive to move forward and do whatever is next for me is definitely a product of where I'm coming from. So that people know that you don't have to stay stuck in that life, right? I think that's one of the biggest impediments for people to come out of street life is because we're taught while we're out there that this is all we can be.
Yeah.
Right. Like, there's this very strong belief that once you hit a certain bottom in society, you can't come out of it. And so I just need to show that that's not true to the greatest extent possible.
Wow. And you have, and you are. And you know what? Like, as much as you are, you know, this beacon for people who are in that place where they're feel at their lowest, you are an inspiration to me right now. Like, listening to your story, I'm like, oh, okay, I got to keep looking. What's my next mountain? And I feel like for everyone listening, for all the women listening who have seen success in their lives and who have checked a lot of boxes, it's giving them really that permission, and not just permission, but almost this sense of like, yes, go look for your next mountain, right? Like, yes, like that is part of our journey. Go see where you can go from here. Are you at full capacity? I love that question. I love that you brought that up. Jordana, this has been an amazing conversation. I loved it. I could talk to you forever. I want to be your friend. I'm saying that right now.
No, you're already friends. You're good.
You're such an inspiration. And, you know, I feel like there's so much more like personally that I would want to share with you about my own life and why this so deeply resonates with me. And so we'll have to do that another time. But thank you so, so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Isn't Jordana's story just amazing? I have so many takeaways from our conversation, but one of the biggest ones was what she shared about capacity. I hope you take a moment to reflect on your own capacity. What capacity are you operating at in life? And do you have room for more? And I don't mean to do more. Let's be clear. We do not need more stuff on our schedules, on our to-do lists. It's not about doing more and packing in more, but it's about expansion, allowing for more in your life, allowing yourself to be more, to step out of the everyday mundane activities that we need to do and to create space and capacity for more growth and more expansion. You can find the links to connect with Jordana in the show notes. Before I go, I want to mention that I have recorded a special secret 3-part podcast series called 3 Pivotal Points to Your Next Chapter of Soul Fulfilling Success. This podcast series won't be available on Apple or Spotify. It is something that I'm sending directly to women who need it. This is for women who are established in their career and have achieved success, but are looking to transition to more soul fulfilling work and achieve success on your terms. This is about crafting your life. If you'd like to receive it, send me a DM on Instagram with the word success and I'll get it right over to you. To find me on Instagram, it's Kena, K-E-N-A underscore all you are. That link is also in the show notes. So you could just scroll right down and click on it and send me a quick DM and I will get that secret podcast series over to you. Thank you so much for listening and I'll see you next week. Thank you for tuning in to today's show. I hope you found inspiration and use this podcast to start stepping into all you are. You can find information that was shared in today's show just below in the show notes. If you love this conversation, please share it with others so they can benefit from it too. You can take a screenshot of this episode and tag me on Instagram or share a link via text or email to a friend. Let's be clear. We need more women stepping into all they are. So go ahead and share away. And of course, subscribe to the podcast so that you receive the latest episodes every week and take a quick moment to rate it and leave a review. Thank you so much. Until next time, remember to keep exploring what it means to be all you are.